Hey everybody, welcome and thanks for joining us here in the second hour with John King. We're talking about the assassination of Princess Diana, and of course we are, well, it feels like we're just really getting started, John. It's funny because there's just so many clues and details to this case and so many, you know, nooks and crannies of the cover-ups and everything else. So I guess we should just kind of continue the conversation really of sure. Where we left off, you know, because there's much more to it. And of course later I want to get to, you know, what actually happened with the car and the mechanics of, you know, how they pulled it off and everything. But let's not leave out the cutout story as well that you want to talk about. So let's just carry on.
Yeah, sure. Well, the cutout, which is my latest book, that came about really obviously as a result of the two previous books. But as I was just explaining before the break, the two previous books are basically contain the findings of my investigation, whereas the cutout now tells a story of the investigation. And perhaps I could just to explain a little, just go back a little bit and just give a little bit of background to explain how this came about, and really to explain how I got involved anyway in investigating Diana's death in the first place, because that's kind of key to what the cutout is all about, really. And it kind of began back in the 90s, when I was editor of, as I said, I was editor of a magazine in this country. It was very, very popular at the time. It's called UFO Reality, and later that kind of morphed into a magazine called Odyssey. But at the time, it was UFO Reality, and as you can probably guess by its title, it was a kind of a X-Files-y UFO kind of magazine. But I think what at the time made us, and it was very, very popular because of the X-Files explosion in the 90s, you know, Britain was just awash with, I don't know, 10 or 12 different magazines to do with various aspects of the kind of X-Files theme. But ours was probably the most popular one at the time on the high street, certainly of the independent ones. And I guess probably because it was, that was the reason that this happened to me, what I'm about to explain now. But I received one day a phone call at the office, which happened all the time, actually. I mean, there was nothing kind of out of the ordinary about that, because, as I say, again, just putting things back into context, in the 90s, everything was UFOs and crop circles, and the whole Area 51 thing really exploded. Yep. It was the anniversary of Roswell. It was a real resurgence of interest in, not just in UFOs, but also, because of the X-Files, the public was kind of suspicious that the government was concealing information about UFOs and aliens, possible even alien government contacts and even collaboration. That whole thing was really, really in the air at that time. It wasn't out of the ordinary at all. And because of that, our magazine was really popular. But also because of that, because our magazine took that stand, that was our slant on the thing. There were a few magazines that really just reported mainly sightings, people's experiences. Others would focus more perhaps on abduction or whatever. But the focus of our magazine, UFO Reality, was really the government cover-up side of things. And my own contribution at that time to the magazine each edition was called John King's X-Files Document, and it was basically looking into various aspects where there might be some kind of concealed information about, I don't know, about UFOs, about aliens, about secret underground bases, etc., etc.
Yeah.
And so because of that, I did receive a lot of phone calls and letters, not so much emails in those days, because the internet hadn't really taken off and emails were still a kind of an emerging thing. But a lot of letters I received, a lot of phone calls from sources claiming they had information about this or that. Some of them turned out to be genuine, some didn't. Some were cranks, some just having a laugh, but some turned out to be quite good sources in the end. So one day, when I did receive this phone call on this particular day, it was an American voice on the end of the phone, and he said he had some information he'd like to talk to me about. He just read one of my articles. I'd just written an article for which I think had been published in the previous edition of the magazine of John King's Exile.com. It was called Project Noah's Ark, and it was about America's deep underground complexes, a network of deep underground complexes in America, and what was going on at these complexes, Area 51 being one of them, perhaps Dulce in New Mexico was another, and
right,
perhaps a dozen or more of these underground complexes. And the American said, look, I have information on similar network of underground bases, not quite so large, but a similar kind of thing going on in your country, in Britain. Are you interested at all? I said, yes, of course, I'm interested. So cut a long story short, we met up. In fact, I met up with this guy four times in all. We met, not every time, but mostly we met at a place called Avery Stone Circles in Wiltshire. Cutting to the quick, what he told me on the fourth occasion I'd met him, it was a strange, I always felt a bit weird with this fellow. It was very, very interesting, very intriguing, what he was telling me. It gave me some great information. A lot of that information ended up, or some of the information ended up in my first book, in Cosmic Top Secret, The Unseen Agenda. In that book, I called him, I named him as Stealth. Stealth was his kind of deep throat name in that book as a source. I never knew his real name. Huh. He told me he was a former Green Beret. He was a former U.S. Special Forces soldier. He'd been in Vietnam. He'd been in Angola. He'd been in other African countries. Since he'd left the Special Forces, legitimately, he'd remained a kind of runner for the CIA. And so that was what he said he was.
Did you believe that?
Well, I didn't know what to believe, to be honest, Henrik. I was taking some of the information he gave me, and what bits I could corroborate, which I was able to corroborate some of it, I used it in my book and in the magazine. But I wasn't sure what to believe. I remember talking to John Beveridge about this. This was my colleague and the person who helped me on my investigation in Diana eventually. He was the associate editor. He was my kind of deputy editor at UFO Reality at the time. I remember saying to him, you know, I can't get my head around this character, this guy who, he was a very kind of mysterious sort of fella. He was almost ordinary looking in some ways, a bit, I don't know, a bit craggy, but he was, you probably could see him in a Special Forces situation. He was a little bit aloof and a bit mysterious, but I couldn't quite, he gave me information specifics, but he also kept wanting to talk about what we would now refer to, I suppose, as the New World Order, and what's really the powers behind what the CIA was. He was talking about the CIA, of course, because he said he was in a at that time in a black ops CIA cell working with MI6. That's why he was in Britain. Anyway, he told me at the very end of this, he told me that there was word of an assassination, an imminent assassination that he said to me would happen within days from now. He said it would be bigger than Kennedy. That's a quote. And he said that the person who was a target, who he said he couldn't name, whether he didn't want to or whether he couldn't, whether he didn't know or whether he was just hiding that from me. At the time, I didn't know. When he told me this, Henrik, I kind of took it almost with a pinch of salt. I honestly didn't believe it.
Healthy way of doing it, right?
Yeah. So he told me all this, and he said his parting words were something like, "The media's being primed. Watch out. The media will, you know, the media will tell you it was an accident, but you will know it wasn't." That's what he said. Okay. This was the fourth and the final time I ever saw, well, not the final time I saw him actually, but it was the final time I saw him in that context, and it was the last time I saw him for some years. So this was on the Saturday before Diana died. He never mentioned Diana, but he did say it was, quote, one of the most prominent figures on the world stage, unquote, will be assassinated, quote, within days from now, unquote. And it'll be reported as an accident. It's exactly a week later. I mean, I did think about it during the week. I kept thinking, when is President Clinton going to be shot or die or something? Or when is the Pope going to fall off his pulpit and whatever, you know?
Right.
One of the most prominent figures. Diana never entered my mind. Perhaps now, in hindsight, she should have done, because she probably was the most prominent figure on the world stage. But until this happened, Henrik, Diana was in my life, didn't exist.
Right.
She was a huge celeb, and I'm not one for celebrity, I have to say. And at the time, I was not a Diana fan. So she just didn't kind of enter my, she wasn't in, on my radar at all. Until, of course, the following 7-8 days later, on the Sunday morning, when the news finally broke. In fact, I got a phone call from John Beveridge. He'd already heard it on the news. I was getting ready to take the kids out. My wife and I were taking the kids out for the day. Probably about 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the phone call, and John said, "Have you heard the news?" I said, "What news?" He said, "Diana, she's brown bread." That was exact words, which in Cockney rhyming slang means she's dead.
Oh.
I said, "Your joke, Princess Diana?" He said, "Princess Diana, she's died. She's died in a car crash in Paris." And I just froze. I just froze. I could not believe what I was hearing. And that's pretty much the way I stayed for the whole day, for the rest of that. I don't know for how long. I just froze. I couldn't believe it. I didn't know. I realized in that moment this was probably what the American had been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
What else could he have been talking about? Was it coincidence? It could be a coincidence. He could have just been, you know, sounding off, trying, having a laugh, and this is just a coincidence. But it's one hell of a coincidence if it is.
Yeah.
And in any event, this was the event that led me to eventually investigate Diana's death. It was a couple of days later. I was numb. I was just numb. I didn't know what to do. I didn't tell my wife. She knew that I'd been meeting this guy. She knew about all my meetings with various sources, but she didn't know what the guy had told me on that final day, because I didn't think it was worth telling her, because I didn't think anything was going to come of it.
Right.
And I didn't want her to worry anyway, because she sometimes worried a little bit about some of the kind of characters I met. And I didn't want her to worry unduly. So I hadn't told her. I didn't tell her for a good few days afterwards, because it was all just going through me. It was running through me like ice. I didn't know what to do. In the end, the only person I didn't get in touch with was Robert Lacey, the guy I told you about earlier, who was still working for MI5 at the time. But he phoned me at the office, and we eventually spoke that evening. This was probably on the Tuesday, I think, after the Sunday, when it happened on the Saturday night.
Right.
And he told me at the time, he said, "What on earth have you been doing?" I said, "What do you mean, what have I been doing?" He said, "Who have you been talking to?" I said, "Well, this character, he told me, what he said, the whole security sector's on meltdown up here." He said, "Be careful who you're talking to. Your phone's on file as a tap." He said, "I've checked. You're on file as a tap," which basically means my phone had been wired.
Mm.
I said, "What do you say? What do you mean?" I was just freaking out. I got so paranoid. I got so worried. I didn't know what to do. I arranged to meet Robert. We met. I can say it now because it doesn't matter. We met in Hyde Park, and this is when he went through. We met. We wandered around the park for I don't know how long. Perhaps an hour, perhaps two. And this is when he told me about Camilla Parker Bowles. This is when he told me about he told me lots of things. But he told me basically that whatever the American had told me was right. Diana had been assassinated. There's no question about it. He knew about it. He knew about the meeting that had taken place in 1995. As I told you earlier, the 18 months beforehand, the meeting when Diana's fate, along with Camilla Parker Bowles' fate, was discussed because of the constitutional crisis that had arisen because of Prince Charles's desire to marry Camilla Parker Bowles while Diana was still alive. This all came from Robert initially. This is where this all came from. Of course, at this stage, Henrik, I had no idea that I'd been set up. I just thought I'd been told something in advance that I wish to God I'd never been told.
Right.
But I had no idea that this was all part of some elaborate MI6, call it what you will, setup. That's what a cutout means, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, a cutout in an operational sense means someone who's a courier between one agent and another, someone who delivers information from one compartment to another compartment. But in general terms, a cutout is someone who's unwittingly used by intelligence agencies to put out information.
Yeah, because I was obviously going to ask, you know, what was the reason, do you think, he contacted you and all this? But just continue the story. It's really interesting how you were a part of this then, and then unwittingly dragged into something like this.
Yes, exactly, completely and utterly. I had no plans whatsoever of ever doing this. I was quite happy in my job. The magazine was going very well. I got dragged into this because I had no choice. I didn't know who on earth knew that I'd met the American. I knew the American knew I'd met him. But if he was party to this kind of information, who else knew? Did his people know? Did other people in his whatever cell he was working for in the CIA or MI6, who else knew that I'd met him? Who else knew what he told me? I was so paranoid. I didn't know what to do. I got in touch with a friend of mine at who worked for the Sunday Mirror, a big tabloid over here in Britain,
mm-hmm.
at the time, and he looked into things for me to see if there's any information he could find out for me. I got in touch with whoever I could, out of desperation almost, and I was led into this investigation myself, out of desperation, little knowing that it was all a setup, because basically, bottom line, I discovered a long time later, perhaps 4 or 5, 6, 7 years later, that because it was precisely because I was generally understood, I suppose, I was known as a conspiracy theorist, if you like, or a conspiracy journalist. I was editor of a UFO magazine. I was the perfect candidate because this may sound a bit twisted, but this is the way they were thinking way in advance of anything I was thinking at the time, because I was probably at the time, and I was at the time, 97, 98, 99, or the mid-90s anyway, probably the best-known conspiracy journalist, if you like, in Britain.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There were other top the other bigger magazines, I suppose, where there was one called UFO Magazine, but that was all nuts and bolts. That was to do with mainly secret advanced technology aircraft that the military were producing. Another one was Nexus, of course. That was about at the time, and that was quite big. But it was a different niche. And another one called 40 and Times, but that was all kind of paranormal stuff. So we were the only one, the biggest one on the market, investigating government cover-ups of various nature. And because of that, I was on TV a fair amount. I was on radio a lot. I had this book out, blah blah. So that I learned eventually. That was the very reason I was selected out and set up for this being a patsy, basically a fall guy, a cutout, was because whatever information I managed to, they kind of second guessed, they banked on the idea that I would get involved and investigate because of my nature. They'd done a profile on me, obviously. They realized through my magazine that I wasn't one to let things drop. I was quite tenacious. I did investigate thoroughly. I did get to the core of things. I tried to investigate and find out as much information as I could in my articles in the magazine. And they were clocking all this all of the time. It's so freaky. It was so eerie. And because I was that, they knew then that, or they gambled on the fact that I would also, because I was told this information, I would get involved in investigating Diana's death, because I would be convinced that she was assassinated, because I've been told in advance that she was going to be assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, when I got involved and I would write my articles, I don't think they realized I would do such a thorough job, and I would still be here 17 years later banging on about it. But they did probably think I would gather some evidence, some information, I would put a story together, write a book, a few articles, and they would be able to do what they do best, which is ridicule everything I said, because they could ridicule me, because they could put me out as a conspiracy theorist. Therefore, everything I said would be conspiracy theory. And that, Henrik, is how a lot of the information and the evidence, even the stuff that was presented to the coroner at the inquest, was in the end kind of given out tongue-in-cheek, kind of, you know, this is conspiracy theory, isn't, you know, really, this is conspiracy theory, isn't it? Ha ha.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's because, or partly at least, to do with the fact that I was set up in this way, and that a lot of the information presented in my books has been associated with other wacky conspiracy, and I mean really wacky ones that some of the intelligence agencies themselves have made up. Diana's still alive. She's living on an island somewhere with Dodi just to get away from it all.
Right.
She's living there with Elvis. You know, he's still alive as well. Ha ha. and even the most, you know, the more serious evidence, when you sit it alongside those kind of, because it's me who's saying those things in my books, not the Elvis stuff. I mean, because I'm the one who's presenting the evidence, I can be shown to be a wacky conspiracy theorist. Therefore, the whole idea, the whole notion that Diana might have been assassinated is a crazy conspiracy theory. And that is the bottom line.
So that's the motive right there. That's the
exactly
why they plan. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned this, because it's obviously a way to use the enthusiasm and the energy of those into conspiracy. And it's also one of these interesting situations that if you talk about it, they win in a way. If you don't talk about it, they also win in a way, right?
Yes,
so this
exactly.
is very, they're chess players, long-term strategists. So
yes.
Yeah, tell us more about it. How'd you find out about this primarily?
How did I find out about? Oh, that was okay. Well, I found out about it because I was visited some years later, and I was told in a kind of almost, it was a big joke. We were at Robert first hinted at the fact that I might have been set up as a cutout, and I didn't want to hear it then. I couldn't really take it on. I didn't understand how that could work. It's only now in hindsight I understand perfectly. But at the time, I was heavily involved in the investigation. Lots of things were happening, you know, in Paris, in London, and talking to witnesses. I was being, don't forget, during the, especially Henrik, during the first, I don't know, 3 years perhaps of sheer intensity, right at the hub of all this, I know I was being followed. I know I was followed home one night by a seriously good driver who was right on my bumper all the way at night with the headlights flashing on and off, to scare me more than anything. I never came to any harm physically,
right.
But I certainly came to harm emotionally and psychologically. There were phone calls going on. There were not threats, but intimidations and insinuations. It was intense. It was very intense. And of course, I couldn't talk about it, because as soon as I mentioned it, people thought I was crazy. People thought, you know, okay, yeah. Even John at one point, my colleague, John Beveridge, you know, he made a joke about it, you know, headlights following you home, John, come on, this and that, come on. And he made a kind of a joke about it. What's convinced John in the end to actually not convince him that, because he wasn't convinced that Diana had been assassinated to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
He was open-minded about it. He was fairly convinced, though, that it was an accident. Henri Paul was drunk, driving too fast. Accidents happen. That was basically what he thought. And it wasn't until really our magazine went down overnight. We were doing so well. This is one of the things that happened. Just one of the things. We were doing so well. We were selling. I can even tell you the figures. We were selling in excess of around about. I mean, we weren't a great big publishing house. Remember, we were just a small independent magazine. We were selling around 60,000 copies an edition.
That's good. And yeah.
Back in the 90s, that was a very good amount. You know.
Yeah.
And it was increasing at the time. We were selling in Australia, America, all over the UK, of course, and a few European countries. We were doing very well. And John and I were, I think we were having a drink in a bar one evening, and the proprietor of the magazine, Dave, walked in with his wife, and he looked like he'd seen a ghost. He looked absolutely white. And either myself or John, one of us said to him, "What on earth's wrong?" And Dave just looked at us. He said, "I'm so sorry." He said, "I've got some really bad news. The magazine's gone under. The wholesaler has pulled the plug. He owes us thousands and untold amounts of money. He's pulled the plug, and the distributors cancelled our account with no explanation overnight." At the same time, literally at the same time, within a couple of days, John and I had been, when this first came out, I didn't know what to do, as I was saying earlier. And one of the first things I did, apart from talking to Robert, was I approached my literary agent at the time, a guy called Nick Austin, who'd been my commissioning editor as well, and my copy editor at Hodder & Stoughton for Cosmic Top Secret. And anyway, through Nick, we got the kind of a synopsis together to put a book out. I thought, this is one thing I know I can do. I don't know what to do, but I can write a book about this and tell people what's happened, about how I was forewarned of this thing. And there was the vague idea of it. I didn't have a whole book, of course, in my head. Only a few days had gone by since the assassination, and I was still in a complete, I didn't know what was going on. I was in a frenzy, but the idea to write a book came to me. So we went with it. And within a week or two, we had certainly the three of Britain's top publishers, Hodder & Stoughton, Jonathan Cape, and Simon & Schuster, three of our top corporate publishers, were all over us, all over me anyway, for the book, for mm-hmm. the story.
Right.
We were wined and dined. There was like a bidding war for the story. Not by commissioning editors either. These were managing directors that were talking to us. You know, the top honchos were courting us for the book.
And was that part of it too?
Well, when the magazine went down, some, I don't know, not long, perhaps a month or so later, around the same time, it was about perhaps a couple of days before the books had gone as well, all three publishers pulled out without explanation. They just phoned up the literary agent and said, sorry, Nick, we can't go with this.
Hmm.
And they were just gone. And they weren't only like offering us a deal beforehand, they were bidding against each other, wining and dining us literally in good restaurants in the West End of London. And but overnight, they pulled out. And then within days of that happening, the magazine went under. And that is when John Beveridge started to okay, something's not right here, something is happening. And that's when he started to look at things slightly differently. And I was a mess, though. I was just a bit of a mess.
What do you think was the motive, though, for pulling the plug on the magazine and kind of making that go under? Wouldn't it be more beneficial to them if they encouraged the increase in the dissemination of the information in that way?
Possibly, Henrik. Who knows how they work? I don't know. What I do know is it made me even more of a mess, but it strengthened John Beveridge's resolve. And I don't know. I honestly don't know what their motive was. I can't prove that they were even involved. I can't prove any of these things, really. All I can tell you is the story. And that's what the cutout, the book, is all about, really. I'm just telling the story because I've come to a point in my life where I can now, as I say, some of the legal constraints that were on it have been lifted. I'm allowed to tell it now. That was to do with the film, by the way. Just so there's no mystery about that. It was just that a production company had the rights on a book to make a film, and so I wasn't allowed to tell the story. Now that's been removed. I've been able to tell the story, and there's a different production company involved in making the film now.
So, possibly.
Who knows? I mean, I would never have thought all this up in the first place. So, I must say, when it comes to how the intelligence agencies plan and carry out their operations, even after all of this, I'm a lot wiser now. But I'm still pretty naive, probably, compared to, you know, the guys who work these things. So why the magazine? I don't know. Why the books? I don't know. I honestly don't know. It seems sometimes they're going against themselves, but that seems to be, it's just a hall of mirrors, smoke and mirrors wherever you look. And
well, it's interesting. I just want to make a quick comparison there as well. There is actually one episode there in the X-Files where the three lone gunmen, the conspiracy theorists in the fictional story, they have a conversation with a high-profile intelligence officer pretty much when he reveals to them, you know, that, oh, you know, you guys have been picking up our false stories for years and disseminating them to the public, you know, and we're making it all up kind of thing. And it's, I'm still kind of split about that, obviously, though, because, I mean, certainly to a large extent, nobody wants to consciously muddy the waters in any regard. Of course not. At the same time, if there are nuggets of truth in what you were told, because I think usually that's how they operate, that they tell you they have to offer something that is for real, otherwise people wouldn't even pick up on it. That would be, you know, wiser than that usually anyway. But so it's not a crime to talk about and discuss it in these things specifically in a very critical light and say, all right, you know, whatever, this is what I was told. I'm not saying it's the truth, but it's for the sake of being adding information to your decision-making process, I still think it's really, really good to do about it. When it becomes unfortunate, I guess, is when people are, you know, convinced, you know, that whatever the source tells them or whatever this is, that's the truth and that's it kind of thing, you know, when you don't have that room for doubt in a way in there. But so I don't think that, I mean, you have not done anything, you know, wrong. Of course not in that regard. I think it is important to discuss it and kind of open those possibilities up and talk about it. And see, now you revealed an extra layer onto the cake as well, which is, you know, possibly even how they operate and the way that they release information, you know, out in that way. But is there anything more that has come to you consequently in terms of the motives for this or the fact that, I mean, have they really been successful in pointing out conspiracy theories as being kooks? I mean, it's still a subject which draws huge amounts of attention. A lot of people are actually honestly looking into these conspiracies because there is a reality in there, you know?
Yeah, I think there's two layers to that. I think firstly, in terms of the public, no, I think the public, you're absolutely right. I think in the public mind, more and more people are becoming open to or not so quick to accept the party line. You know, I think more and more people are beginning to question and look into what really happened on 9/11. Did Diana really die in an accident? Was JFK killed by a lone gunman? Really, all of these things. You know, I think people are beginning to look and question. They're waking up to various possibilities on that level. But what it does do, Henrik, is in an official, legal, legitimate way, it means that Diana's, for example, Diana's inquest, the verdict, could not be murder. It couldn't be murder. There was no way it could, officially, legally, legitimately, so that it caused proper, real ripples and made a real difference to the establishment, and so that the people who did it were brought to account. Yes, the public carry on to they know. They're not, as you say, they're not daft. You know, the public know when something's not right. They know, and they certainly knew when Diana was killed. You know, a vast majority believed, at the very least, it was kind of suspicious. It wasn't an accident, and large numbers just plainly thought she'd been murdered. But it still doesn't change anything. It didn't change the status quo, like it could have done, had they not planned it the way they did. All the evidence that went before the coroner at the inquest had already been filtered through the lens of conspiracy theory.
Mm-hmm.
And so it carried that quirk, that slight tint, that color of, it's a little bit cranky. It's not really true. At least it's not true enough that it will persuade or convince a coroner or to say to the jury, okay, if you like, you can go in there and you can come up with a verdict of murder, you know. So, you know, that's the difference. It's a very subtle, very clever difference, but the difference all the time is that Kennedy's death doesn't bring down the American government or the American establishment. It doesn't really even change it that much. Same with Diana. Same with any other really big, like 9/11. We all know, well, I certainly believe, as I think a lot of people do, that some bearded Muslim in a cave in Afghanistan did not plot and carry out 9/11. Not in my opinion, anyway. And I think a lot of people know that. We can all put different takes on it. Some people might say George Bush was behind it. Some people might say the CIA weren't actually behind it, but they knew it was going to happen. They allowed it to happen. Others will say the CIA funded it and arranged it, but it was actually, you know, there are various, but the bottom line is lots of people, probably the majority of people, know that it wasn't quite the way we've been told officially that it happened. But there's never quite enough solid, legitimate evidence that can be presented in a judicial inquiry or trial or courtroom to bring those who actually did do it to account. And that's the difference. And I think I haven't really thought about this before quite so deeply. It is your question that's kind of prompted these thoughts to come to the fore. But I think that this scenario I'm talking about here of I don't know if I was the only one either, but I know what my story was or is.
Yeah.
And being set up in this way and writing books, presenting evidence, a lot of evidence. And we also found out, you know, we went all the way, the full Monty, as we say in England. We went all the way. We discovered exactly how it happened as well, the logistics of the operation, how it actually happened, because that hadn't been done before, you know. But still that wasn't even broached at the inquest. And it wasn't broached because the evidence came from myself and John, who are branded before we go anywhere. Our reputation goes before us. We're conspiracy theorists. Lord Stevens, just a quick point, Henry. Lord Stevens is well aware of me and our book and my books. An editor at The Guardian who had my book and wasn't allowed to publicize it because there's an MOD DA notice on our two books, which prevents the British press from serializing it and publicizing it. And it's because of the we were told by the editor and by another senior reporter at the Sunday Mirror, it's because it contains information that might compromise the agents and operations of Britain's secret intelligence service. Now, you work that out yourself. I mean, Why have we been DA noticed, which means it's a defense notice, which is on the surface it's only a guideline. It's the government saying we don't think you should broadcast, but really it's an official warning. It's everything but it's an official warning, and they know that if they do publish it, they'll lose their license to broadcast or to publish.
Yeah.
So you know.
Let me tie it back a little bit and see.
Yeah.
There's a couple other things that came to me as well as you were talking about this, because there's something among this within this that is very interesting in it, and it's also, you know, bothers me to a certain extent. There's a couple of things to this, and let me say it this way. There's of course a level where they the let's say the international intelligence community, for the lack of a better term, is trying to steer people away from, you know, quote unquote, the real story, or in some cases worse, harness using the energy and the motivations and momentum of a movement, let's say, who are convinced that they are right, and this movement is trying to push policy, influence other people's opinions, etc. Sure, there is a danger to that, but again, then I think the only time that would be dangerous is when people are almost religiously inclined to think that they hold all the truth and nothing but the truth, you know, in that regard. And I think it's, again, this is for those who are drawn into the official world, those who are seeking, perhaps, as you say, kind of a good reputation among the establishment or the authorities. They seek legitimacy in this kind of atmosphere.
Yeah.
Again, those who stand outside of that, who are not concerned with this level, they are, of course, free to theorize, speculate, and talk about any level of information that they will. Because I think sometimes, again, there's this disservice that's made to people where, because these accusations are always flying around out there. I mean, I can't even tell you how much there is online about this, that, or the other, or this person is, you know, doing this intentionally, or they're muddying the waters, or they're doing this, you know. And I always kind of ease off on the gas pedal on those kinds of accusations, because yeah, yes, sure, it might be true, but at the same time, it's just this. I mean, this is freedom of speech kind of territory, really. I mean, we have to be allowed to theorize, we have to be allowed to speculate, and as long as you don't, you know, then come out there and say this is, you know, the only thing I'm going to say now is the truth, and that's it. That's the only, you know. That's the only area when you're in on thin ice, so to speak. But otherwise, it's all right. And I'm not trying to say either, just to kind of wrap that thought up, I'm not trying to say either that there isn't such a thing as the truth. And of course, there's things that are going to be flying in the way of that, as you just kind of demonstrated with this very idea that intelligence community is feeding information to certain people to help to kind of muddy the water. So there's a very fine balance there where you need to tread. You know what I mean? But I think it's also a disservice of throwing around these accusations, you know, because then people could basically say, well, now you're part of this, and now you're guilty, you know, of being. But at the time, you didn't know better. You had to talk about it, and that was it. As long as people continue to search for the answers and the truth and set the story straight, we're all right, you know. It's going to be good.
Yeah, good. I mean, that's the one of the main motives behind writing The Cutout, actually, Henrik. Is, I mean, I always admired Oliver Stone for this very reason, for making JFK the movie, was ultimately, you know, whether intelligence agencies are feeding us this or this or that, they're obviously trying to muddy the waters to cover their tracks.
Yeah.
They don't want to be brought to account. They won't be brought to account. They're too clever for that. But ultimately, the people know. And one thing I think the movie JFK did that perhaps no non-fiction work, say for example Jim Marr's book on JFK nothing against Jim Marr's great, and I really admire him. I'm just saying that any non-fiction work presenting the facts and the evidence about JFK is one thing, but I think what Oliver Stone got really, really right was he just presented the story on screen, or, you know, there you are. And the public came to see it, and they kind of watched that film, I think, and they went away and felt vindicated. They thought, well, if I can say this, they've probably thought, you know, well, sod you. Now we know. There it is. We've seen it. That's the story of how it happened. It's probably not exactly how it happened, but nonetheless, there's a kind of a vindication in that, in just putting out the story. That's what inspired me probably more than anything to actually write The Cutout now, because I can almost close a chapter on it. And I'm not giving up. Don't get me wrong. I'm not a quitter, but I've toiled, and it's been intense. You know, it's taken up a huge chunk of my life. It changed my life completely. Mm. It took over my life for a long period of time. And writing the two nonfiction books on this was heavy going sometimes. But writing The Cutout is me just saying, now, look, this is what I learned. And I did learn an awful lot. Not all of it is right, I'm sure of that. I'm not perfect. But a lot of it I know is probably close to the truth. And so here we are in a book. There it is. This is the story. Now, please just go away and make your own mind up. And I hope you can feel kind of vindicated reading that about your belief in that the Diana was assassinated, in the same way I felt when I watched JFK. You know, there's something in that of just like, as you were saying, it's not really pushing it on anybody. It's not saying, we know. It's just saying, this is what happened.
Yeah.
This is actually what happened because I was there. I was just by fate, by kismet, by whatever you want to call it, I happened to be thrust to the center of this arena, this particular arena, and this is my story. This is what happened, and this is what I found out. This is what I told. What I was told, and yeah. That's all. No more claim to it than that, really. And you know, and so that's it, just leading on from what you were saying then about you know, about not really coming up and saying that this is the truth. I don't want it to be a religion. You know, it's just this is what happened. This is actually what happened.
Mm, yeah. Well, it's what happened to you, you know, and
yes, exactly, yeah.
And again, it's just as long as you use those certain precautions, you know, even in your language and how you present things. I think there's still a huge benefit to do it that way. And I mean, there's that other aspect to this as well that I've been brushing on here, and I guess I could ask you about that as well when just being in this environment, if you will, of these kinds of topics. But there are, you know, speculations that have been, you know, flung here and there that there's also at the same time them building right now kind of almost an entire new culture of conspiracy, that this is a new religion almost of sorts.
Yeah.
At the same time, then again, to defend that, anything can be used against you, no matter how well you present it, I think. And it's because unfortunately,
yeah,
it's very much about harnessing other people's opinions about you as opposed to like the material. There are so many, you know, things that fly around in people's rational mind that are, you know, quite not there yet either to a certain extent. But you know, again, just to go back on that, then at the same time, you know, if you put all your weight, you know, of everything you got kind of behind those ideas, and then, you know, that's it. It's kind of like Robert Anton Wilson said, you know, it's like, yeah, a lot of people believe in wacky conspiracies, but one of the reasons for that is because there are a lot of true conspiracies out there as well, you know. So
exactly, yeah, it. Exactly, yeah, yeah, definitely.
So this is a very interesting story then, how this unfolded, and there's obviously much more to we could talk about here. I wanted to ask you just briefly. I mean, and certainly let's keep the cutout story in mind here in the background, yeah, as we talk about this. But many people also even speculated, I don't mean to go off topic too much, but even the murder of Diana was a ritual murder with the timing and the placing, and I wanted to ask you what you make of that and what you think the possibilities of that are, because it's, again, sometimes it feels like we're giving the intelligence community way too much credence, but at the same time, they are, I think, a bunch of really clever long-term chess player type people, and they know what they're doing, and they know how to do it just so. So what's your take on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of talk about it at the time, of course, as well. I mean, to be honest with you, Henrik, it's not something I've really followed up too much. I mean, I know, yes, Diana was crashed into the 13th pillar, and it was in an ancient sacred space for the Merovingian kings, the actual tunnel, the Almar tunnel. There's a lot of information that links the assassination with bloodlines, and that's an interesting point in itself, because that is something we did follow up very, very intensely. There's probably not time to talk about all of that tonight, but as keeping to what you've just asked me, literally about the ritual killing of Diana, I have to say to you, I don't know. I honestly don't know the answer to that one, and I'm not sure what my feeling is on it.
Yeah.
What I do know is I believe that she was assassinated, and I think there are good, legitimate political and social reasons, as well as historical reasons behind that. Whether there are, whether the actual operation and the mode of the assassination was ritually based, I don't doubt it, but I don't know. I honestly don't have an opinion, to be honest, because it's just not something that I've really, really looked at too closely.
What can we say more about the you know, the tampering with the car then, and all there's a lot of puzzle pieces that just had to fall in place, you know, all the things at the right time with the people and the vehicles in charge. And again, maybe it isn't that every single component was successfully executed and every person there did so many things right. I mean, we've talked with other people about these kinds of assassinations, for example, are Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme with Ulla Dammegård, the Swedish researcher, Swedish-Danish researcher, yeah. And he mentioned as well that there was like multiple, and I definitely concur with him there, there's multiple operations running at the same time with a bunch of different people involved, and there were backups within, you know, all kinds of things to cover your bases and to cover the what-ifs kinds of scenarios. So if something doesn't, you know, rightly work, there's always another people, a person or item or something there in place to kind of see to it that it's executed in the way they want.
Well, certainly we know that there's, well, we did discover probably a year or so into our investigation, we got wind of an operation called the Boston Breaks. You've probably heard of that now. So we're pretty convinced, I'm certainly convinced, that that was the operation that was used to assassinate Diana. Of course, there are various aspects to that, and I absolutely agree. There are no stone left unturned. You know, there are multiple layers of that operation to ensure, to cover this base, to cover that base. What if that doesn't happen? What if that goes wrong? We can cover it this way. You know, we know, for example, the Mercedes in which Diana was being driven that night, that was the car they were going to use. They knew that months in advance. There's no question about that. The limousine company who hires limousines to the Ritz Hotel specifically said after the event, and they said that night as well, this was the only available car. There's no way that Diana normally would have got in an S-Class Mercedes. If I might say so, it's a bit below the British aristocracy, that model of a Mercedes.
Right.
But that was the only available car that night. It's the same car that just happened. It was stolen at gunpoint prior to the crash. The EMS, the computer chip, basically, that controls the steering and the traction control and the brakes, was stolen. There's a whole lot of mystery around that. I don't know all the answers to that. What I do know is the car was stolen, and I also know that the EMS chip, the computer chip, was the only thing that was missing when the car was found mysteriously. Again, the car was returned. It was returned and found, just it didn't have its chip. Who put the new chip in and what that chip really was, I don't know. But I do know that when I spoke to an old kind of an acquaintance of mine, someone called Dave Cornish, he was a sergeant in the SAS. He said he's personally has been involved in Boston Breaks operations, and that is exactly how it's done. The car is stolen, if you like, or goes missing prior to the event, and it's tampered with so that when the event comes around, it can be controlled remotely. This is not just crazy James Bond talk. This is fact. It's fact corroborated by Sir Arnulf Fiennes, world famous explorer and personal friend of Prince Charles, Sir Arnulf Fiennes, who himself is a former SAS officer. He's written a book himself called The Feathermen that tells about the Boston Breaks. It tells about a real assassination that actually happened in Britain, the assassination of an SAS officer by an assassination squad hired by a Yemeni prince. This was an SAS officer called Major Michael Marmon. He was killed in a car crash, and he was killed in very similar circumstances. His car the target car was it's a bit complicated. It's in the book. There's probably not time to explain it all, but nonetheless, he was the victim of a Boston Breaks operation, according to Sir Arnulf Fiennes. Now, Sir Arnulf Fiennes is no conspiracy theorist, far from it. As I say, he's a personal friend of Prince Charles. He's a former SAS officer, world-famous explorer. You know, he's come forward and says that Boston Breaks is real and it's used. And, you know, so we know that the car was stolen. Probably the chip was replaced. Certainly, we know the car was chased into the tunnel that night by a team of vehicles, not just one vehicle. It wasn't just the white Fiat Uno became quite famous and talked about after the event. But there were several other vehicles that were involved in the operation. We believe that's how it happened. And we think it was a Boston Breaks operation where as the Mercedes approached the crash tunnel, the white Fiat Uno moved out into the lane. It caused the Mercedes to just clip the Uno. The Uno then the Uno was being driven by a special forces operative, I suppose you would call it. There was a passenger in there who's called the engineer in technical terms, in operational terms. The engineer would have had the remote control in his hand. And at that moment, the engineer took over the steering and the brakes of the brakes were blown out, and the engineer took over the steering of Diana's car. And from that moment on, Henri Paul had no
control
at all. Yeah. And we know that. We know that as well, because both the French and the British investigation found out that there were no tire marks at the event. Now, you imagine a car, yeah, a Mercedes, a four tons of a Mercedes crashing into a concrete pillar, and the driver didn't even try to any kind of correctional maneuver. There was no tire marks, no skid marks, no tire marks made by the Mercedes, which means only one thing, that the brakes failed. This is official. The French investigation found this out. The brakes failed, just as Henri Paul drove into the tunnel.
Just as she said in the letter as well.
Exactly. All of this ties in so many different ways.
Sorry to interrupt, but how do you think that she knew about this? Why was she convinced that this was the case, do you think?
Because she said she had sources who were telling her this. She had an affair with one of her bodyguards who was an MI5, not quite MI5, he was a royal bodyguard.
Right.
Sergeant Barry Manicky. He died conveniently a little while later, just after the affair with Diana, in an accident.
Yeah.
She had her sources. She said she had sources. She knew that her apartments were being bugged by MI5. She knew that she was, conversations were being recorded. Her telephone was bugged, and she was convinced. As she said, she told Paul Burrell, her butler. She told, I can't remember his name offhand now, but her personal secretary. She told Lord Mishcon, who was her personal friend and lawyer. He was the one she gave the famous note to. Now, she obviously knew from somewhere, from her sources, that she was either going to die in a helicopter crash, she said, or in a car crash. Her note cited specifically a car crash, and that the reason for the crash would be that her brakes would fail, and she would crash at high speed, and it would be a deliberate operation that did it. And she finished that note by saying, I'm going to paraphrase this, Henrik, because I haven't got the exact quote in front of me, but this is very, very close. If I do die in a car crash, the world will know. No, that's right. She said, I'm writing this note because if I do die in a car crash, the world will know that it was MI5 and MI6 who did it.
Mm-hmm.
That's a quote.
Yeah.
So she knew. She had her sources who told her. So obviously they all knew that the Boston brakes was never heard of really before this came out, but once it did come out, there are lots and lots of examples of where it's been used.
Yeah.
From the Middle East to Northern Ireland to Britain, as I just explained, the one that Sir Ranulph Fiennes spoke about. So it was obviously well known within the security community, intelligence community.
And sadly, then she, despite all this, well, of course, I mean, it's like, where do you go? I mean, she didn't want to stop live her own life, I guess, to a certain extent, but she knew about it, she was aware of it, and yet she couldn't stop it. It happened.
Well, exactly, she couldn't stop it. No, as she said, if it does happen to me, it wasn't. She didn't write the note to try and stop it. She wrote the note, as we know, to warn people that if it does happen to me, as I believe it's going to happen, because I think my husband, as she said in her note, is planning it, it will happen. If it does happen, then you'll know that it was MI5 and MI6 who did it. So she was writing the note really almost as a dead woman walking. She believed that she knew she was an attempt was going to be made on her life, and she believed that she knew it would be in the form of a car crash, and so she wanted to make it public that If it does happen, she wanted the world to know who was behind it. But of course, when she gave the note to Lord Mishkon, and she did die in a car crash, Lord Mishkon then took the note to Scotland Yard, to the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, Lord Condon, who, instead of giving it to the French inquiry, conveniently tucked it away in a safe in the Metropolitan in Scotland Yard. And had it not been for, as I say, Paul Burrell some years later revealing the fact that this note had been written, it would never have come to light. It was covered up. It was deliberately covered up by the former Metropolitan Police Commissioner, Sir Paul Condon. No doubt about that.
Yeah.
You know?
Now, the continuation to this was, of course, the delay in the arrival of the ambulance. There was even video footage of Diana alive in the car, right, after all this. There's been a scandal in itself about that, the fact that they didn't
absolutely,
jump
yeah.
on this in time, right?
Absolutely, yes. There was so many. These were some of the kind of unanswered questions I was talking about at the very beginning of our talk tonight, Henry. Yeah, the French emergency operation. I mean, it took them Lord knows how long to get Diana from the scene to the hospital. She was still alive in the car. It took them, I don't have the facts and figures in front of me right now, but it took them just under 2 hours to get her from the crash scene to a hospital that was less than 4 miles away. Just under 2 hours to get. Now, the French do have this kind of unspoken guideline, I suppose, that the SAMU ambulances that they use in Paris are, they claim they're kind of operating theatres on wheels. Well, they're not. And anyone in any case who's been in a high impact collision like that, the first thing you need to do, whether you're in France or anywhere else, really, is ensure that there's no internal bleeding and no loss of blood pressure, because that could be fatal, obviously. That's what happened to Diana in the end.
Yeah.
And so the first thing, you have to get them to hospital as quickly as possible. Even taking into account that perhaps in Paris they do things differently, perhaps where it might have taken 15 or 20 minutes to get Diana to hospital in England, it might have taken a bit longer in Paris, but 2 hours? 2 hours to get her to hospital? She was still alive on arrival at hospital.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
she
that's
certainly
that's
still
long
alive
even
in the car.
For a socialized medicine.
Exactly. Exactly. And then, and even then, the ambulance stopped for 10 minutes, for a further 10 minutes, just outside the hospital. The senior paramedic claims to because Diana, her blood pressure had dropped again, and he needed to attend to her or something. Well,
yeah.
You know, we can draw our own conclusions on this. Yeah, there are lots of anomalies like that. You know, that within a few hours of the crash itself, the entire tunnel was swept clean and disinfected. It was reopened in time for the rush hour in the morning, of course, therefore destroying crucial forensic evidence.
Yep.
Why?
Yep.
Why did that happen? Paul Burrell was ordered to burn Diana's clothes. He was ordered to burn Diana's blood-stained clothes, the clothes she was wearing. Immediately after the crash, he did. He put them in the incinerator and they were burned. Again, destroying crucial forensic evidence. There's lots of questions, you know. CCTV footage, that's another thing. Where's the CCTV of it? Anything at all. There's none whatsoever of the car chase or of the crash. It's a joke. Henri Paul's blood sample, the very sample that upon which the drink drive verdict was based, it contained unheard of levels of carbon monoxide. Anyone could, with that level of carbon monoxide in their blood, would not have been able to drive a car. We've had four of the world's leading forensic scientists testifying to this fact, and still it's ignored, completely ignored. The blood sample was never even DNA tested. There's no proof that sample even belonged to Henri Paul. It was stored at the morgue in a vial that was labeled unknown male. That was the label on this blood sample.
Hmm.
This came to light in the British investigation. So whose blood really was that? Because the level of carbon monoxide in that blood sample suggests that it belonged to someone who just committed suicide by inhaling exhaust fumes, you know, in an enclosed space. That's the level of carbon monoxide you'd expect. Henri Paul died instantly. We know that for absolute fact. His neck was snapped in the on impact, so he never took a breath. There's no way he could have breathed in the amounts of carbon monoxide, even if any did leak from the car or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's also acknowledged. It's just an anomaly that the coroner brushed over. There's so much to discuss. Henri Paul, there's another, we're talking about his blood sample, his bank accounts as well, to prove, as if to prove, he was working for someone. He was found anyway in his wallet at the time, was the number of his contact at the French DST, the French intelligence agency, domestic intelligence. It was admitted at the inquest that he was a French intelligence asset. The only thing that they denied was that he was working for MI6. But certainly he had something in the region of $300,000 stashed in multiple bank accounts around Paris at the time of his death. Around 80,000 of that had been deposited in cash in the final 8 months of his life.
Oh boy.
I mean, his salary was like £20,000 a year.
Yeah.
So, and Diana, her embalming, she was embalmed. Who gave the order to do that? Why was she embalmed? It's against the law in France to embalm someone unless permission is given by a member of the family. Well, it wasn't given by a member of the family. A fellow called Keith Moss ordered that she be embalmed. And Keith Moss was the senior British diplomat at the British Embassy that night, where the MI6 cell was based that night. He gave the order for Diana to be embalmed. And of course, because she was embalmed, the formaldehyde used in the embalming process corrupted all toxicological tests. And so therefore, it made it impossible to tell whether or not she was pregnant.
Oh, boy.
So you tell me.
Yeah.
You know, again, it's just little things like, well, I say little things. I mean, lots of things like this, Henry. There's just, and there's a whole list of things that probably there aren't even time to talk about tonight.
Well, we could pick this up at another time, too, because it's very interesting and just a continuation of this. Let me ask you, there's another thing here, then, though.
Yeah.
Last point here.
Sure.
As you were talking about some of the other things, I was thinking back again to the cutout kind of scenario from the point of view of your source, Stealth, as you call him, who attempted then to basically, you know, play you and make you part of this whole thing.
Yeah.
That is in itself is a huge gamble, you know, to reveal information of these things as there will be. You know, things in there that are true, I believe. Otherwise, you would realize that. But was there any portion of the information that was released to you, as you thought about it in hindsight, that was given for the sake of aiding in the ridicule of you or the topic itself? Or was it all really good stuff?
Possibly just the fact. Well, I think a lot of it was pretty good stuff. The fact that I was who I was enough. You know, it's almost like. It doesn't matter what the messenger says if the messenger is a wacko.
Right.
Even if the messenger is 100% correct in what they're saying, not that I'm saying I was, I'm just saying even if the information given to the messenger is 100% correct, in fact, even more so then, you think about that. Every single piece of corroborative and definite evidence, if it's given to the guy who's a wacko to courier to the people, perfect, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because the evidence by its nature then, by its association with the wacko, becomes wacko in itself. Even the good, crucial, definite evidence gets tinged, tainted with, you know, the crazy conspiracy theorist who wrote about it or who talked about it. So really, yeah, I mean, it's...
And that's, you know, people know that, but it's that's an ad hominem right there. It means to attack the man, the person, as opposed to looking at the data and the information. But again, people are so inclined to seeking the credentials and the authority that's they're staring themselves blind on that. Not that that's a bad idea sometimes, of course. It could be very beneficial and great, but that's not the only thing that we're talking about here. You know, there's way more than that. Yeah. So, yeah.
But that's, that's in terms of bringing the perpetrators to account. In terms of the public, I don't think necessarily the public, or certainly generally speaking, the majority of the public, certainly the ones we spoke to, the ones we spoke to in our radio phone-in interviews, the people we spoke to at our talks and lectures all over the country. We've got a lot of support, and they didn't look at me as a crazy conspiracy theorist who tainted the evidence. But in terms of the actual inquest, when it comes down to a legitimate judicial inquiry or inquest, that evidence takes on this crazy conspiracy theory taint, if you like. And so it's never enough. It's never strong enough then to actually bring the perpetrators to account because it's tainted.
Yeah, exactly. And then it's like that will be associated with the person. So even if that comes up in another, from another person who has authority, it's like, no, that's what that person said. Yeah. So it's, all of this is just within the realm of people who seek, you know, the authority of the approved, you know, people who are allowed to talk about this or whatever. But
sure.
So I still don't think it's a bad thing, you know, because I think it's still good, and you're trying to set that record straight, and that's all we can, you know, ask of you to do as well on top of that. But you know, I mean, if we also have to talk about, you know, blame or anything like that, just a thing that came to me as well. I mean, who are the monkeys, frankly, who just, well, monkeys, it's too bad for the monkeys to call them that, but these monsters who just follow orders and do what they're told, and they cover up on demand. They just, you know, it's like, that's really where the problem lies, where people in their behavior of just completely following orders without thinking or having any kind of moral conduct of what they're involved in or doing. I mean, if that wasn't the case, if people said, no, I'm not going to do that, I'm not, you know, I'm not that kind of person, walk away from it, you would be left stranded with the person with the original intent standing there with no one to back him up to do this crime to begin with, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree, Henrik. I unfortunately, there are just, you know, psychopaths in this world who organize these things and carry these things out. But there are also people kind of caught up in that mesh. They're just caught up, and their whole livelihood, their whole lives depend on remaining a part of this elite network of in this country. It's largely kind of either extremely wealthy businessmen and corporate people, and the aristocracy. There's this whole, you know, well, I'm sure you're aware of this whole scenario, but there's the whole elite thing going on. There are people caught up in that who their whole livelihood depends on it. You know, so if they walk away from that, what have they got? I'm just trying to say why they continue this myth, why they carry it out. And they've got to sleep at night. They've got to sleep with their conscience, you know. Thankfully, I don't have to. But
they probably fall asleep as babies too, you know. No problem.
Yeah, I know.
It's great every night.
That's a scary thing.
Oh, boy. Well, yeah. As I said, I'd love to have you back and talk more about this. We've covered some of the bases here, but there's much more to it. Let me just again just mention here then the books, The Cutout. That's the autobiographical spy thriller that's based on this true story of how you were set up by the MI6 in the cover-up operation that followed then Princess Diana's death. And then there is Princess Diana, The Hidden Evidence, and Princess Diana, the Evidence. But what's next for you, John? What are you working on right now? Continuing to promote the book, of course, but anything else?
Yeah, a lot of my time is taken up at the moment because, of course, as anyone who reads the book will find out why. I won't go into it right now, but I've published this one myself, deliberately so, because I've just been so screwed over by publishers in the past, and there are certain things, even with the Diana books, that I won't go into right now, but it's in the book, in The Cutout. It explains why. So because of that, anyway, you know, in order to try and promote the book, it's very difficult because, you know, you don't have a big publisher's promotional budget to get it out there. You don't have all the paid for reviews and all of this, all the big publishers have all set up before they release a book. So it's very difficult trying to promote a book. So what I'm saying, that's taking up quite a bit of my time at the moment. I am also, of course, you know, working on the screenplay. The screenplay for the film from the book. Working with the producer on that at the moment. So he's out there looking for, trying to tie up funding to get the film made, which would be really great if that can happen, because Not just for the money. I mean, people, that's one thing that's sort of thrown at me quite a lot. You know, you must have made so much money out of all this. All these Diana books sell millions. Well, I can tell you, I've lost a load more money than I've ever made on this, believe me. And it's not for it, but when I was explaining to you just now, Henrik, about the JFK film, that would be my dream, to get this one made into a film as well, because to put it in front of an audience, and just so the audience can go there and watch what, at least what's close to what probably happened, I just think it could bring closure to a lot of people on that, and they just think, yes, okay, I've seen it now. It doesn't matter what the authorities tell me anymore. I've seen a real viable, possible way that this could have happened, and that's enough, you know. So I'd love to get it made just for that reason. So I'm working on that.
Let me just say this as well, because I'm tired of hearing that about the money and everything. I mean, you're revealing the story as you see it. It's the truth. And why not, in that situation, why not be in a position where you actually make money, enabling you to continue the inquiry? You have the means to spread the... I mean, think about it. With that money, with your true intention of giving this information out and sharing it with the world, and if people have a reciprocal, you know, attitude to that and support you and get the book, you literally could buy ad time on the major networks on TV and say, buy this book, look at this, here's the truth. This is a stigma that people within this field has fallen into, where they think that they associate money with evil and therefore we're not to touch it and whatever. But that's part of the conspiracy, to shut people down so that they no longer have any means to operate, you know, professionally within this world and continue to spread the message. It takes money to operate in this world, and that's just it. And if more people had an attitude and spent the money and made the money on good things, then we would start a positive trend. What's wrong with that? You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. That's a good point, and that's a good point. Well, just leading on from that, then the only book I'm making any money from is The Cutout. So if anyone wants to help this investigation along even further and help to get the film out there and to get the book out there, then please purchase The Cutout. I mean, buy the hidden evidence and the evidence as well, but all that money's going to I don't see anything from that. That goes to the publisher, and that's another story that we can perhaps talk about another time. I won't go into that because there are probably libel issues there, but right. The Cutout itself is the only book. That's that, and that is why I published it myself, because there's no legal problems with that one. It's an independent publication, and so that's the only one that any money comes to me from.
Well, I do hope that everyone who's listening and is interested in this will support you and buy the books and get involved and help you along in the process of revealing all the data about this. That's a good way to do. We have to start supporting each other, everybody out there. This is the idea. That's how this works. That's how we spread a positive economy within all the corruption and the tyranny we see, instead of just handing over our power and consequently all the money to all the people who are doing all the evil in the world. So get on board, everybody. Get onto this. This is it's so easy. The system is there to operate this within a good sphere of a good positive, you know, feedback loop and a good bubble. So it's time to people get smart to that.
Yeah, thank you very much, Henrik. I appreciate that.
You bet. Now, okay, well, thank you then again for coming on, John, and sharing this story with us and for doing your work. Keep up the good work, and we'll have you back at some point and talk more about the story, okay?
That's absolutely my pleasure, and I look forward to talking to you again. That'd be great.
We have some good programs coming up with Christopher Bolin, Kung Pop Yu Yen, Karen Hudes, Barbara Peterson, David Icke, Daniel Estelin, and Marty Leeds. In the meantime, stay tuned to our website for much more news, and Red Ice Radio will be back in just a few days. A big thanks to all our members, to you for listening, and also my thanks to Frederick, Lana, Elizabeth, and John. Have a good day or evening, okay? And stay well. We'll talk to you again. Bye-bye.